Oops. We should call the meeting to order. The meeting of the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee today for Dog Days. And the first bill will be Representative Hornstein. Does anybody want to move the bill for Representative Hornstein? Representative Pittman moves the bill. Representative Hornstein, present your bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Happy to...
I'm sorry. I'm going to limit the time to 9 minutes on each side, and then 1 minute total from people from the audience with a maximum of about 20 seconds for each of those afterwards, and then 10 minutes. We're in such a bind because session ran over. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to kick off Dog Day afternoon here. I do appreciate your hearing the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, and I've certainly learned a lot about this topic since it was brought to my attention over a year ago. Members, Minnesota is among the top states for mass-produced puppies, and that's what House File 2469 addresses. We have the number of dog and cat breeders increasing annually. And this bill fulfills a need because there's nothing in state statutes that addresses care of dogs and cats in breeding facilities in state statutes. Many animals live out their lives in small, overcrowded wire cages and are bred repeatedly. Their cages are often stacked one on top of the other, allowing feces and urine to fall into the animals below. Animals may be sick from inadequate food, water, and veterinary care. Many have injured and deformed paws or severely matted or burned from sitting and standing in the urine and feces. The puppies and kittens from these facilities are then sold to the public. So this is not only a question of humane treatment of animals, it's also a consumer protection bill. So problems with aggression and extreme fearfulness are common traits found in these animals that live under what I would describe as extreme conditions. In these breeding facilities, they have, because of the lack of socialization and their treatment, socialization with other puppies and kittens. And animals living in unsanitary conditions are prone to disease and parasites that can be passed on to the broader population as well. And so while the licensing of certain breeders and dealers falls under USDA, many breeders are not required to be licensed or meet standards of care that don't meet the standards of care and are not inspected. So that's part of what this bill does, sets up a regimen for inspection, standards of care, and really fills in at its core loopholes. We have a number of loopholes that need to be filled. So we have packets that go into some of the things that I was describing verbally, and I don't want, in the interest of time, you know, go through all the sections of the bill. If members have specific questions, I have two testifiers that can deal with that. But you'll see in the pictures being passed around how many dogs, cats, and puppies and kittens, how they live. And some of these are in the USDA licensed facilities, and some are those of private citizens. So in conclusion, I wanted to just mention a couple of things that have been raised that maybe need to be clarified. I originally introduced a different House File 1046. That was 17 pages long. And so we have, partially in response to some of the concerns raised about that initial bill, we have cut it in half just about the bill before you. We have significant changes in that redraft which we can talk about, but I don't want members to be confused between this bill, House File 2469, and House File 1046. This is a different bill. It's much more streamlined, and I hope that it has met some of the concerns that have been brought forth to us. So you can see from the pictures, letters, and news articles that we have a problem. This bill goes a long way in dealing with that problem, and I hope to have your support. I know there's questions and concerns, and that's why we have a couple of experts to address those. So with that, Mr. Chairman, would you want to go straight into this testimony, to the whatever your preference is?
Representative Hornstein, I just want to clarify, there was a question from a couple of people where it went. It goes after here to Agricultural, Rural Economics, and Veterans Committee.
Correct.
And do you have Ms. Minion and Mr. Clark to testify,
yes,
or to answer questions?
Yes. At the table I have James Clark, who represents the Animal Humane Society, and Nancy Minion, who's a citizen who's worked on animal welfare legislation for 18 years. She also runs a nonprofit dog and cat rescue organization, and I have come to know her and respect her over these last months that I've learned about this problem and introduced the bill, and I think there's very few people as knowledgeable and as concerned and as passionate about this issue. So I've enjoyed working with her, and I know that she'll be able to address any particularly technical questions that you have. So, Ms. Minion, why don't you start, and then we'll have Ms. Clark, maybe Mr. Clark, fill in the blank.
Joe, I didn't know. This isn't a neutering bill, is it?
we'll have Mr. Clark fill in any of the spots that.
Okay, Ms. Minion, state your name and go ahead.
Nancy Minion, and I am a citizen who works on animal welfare legislation. What we'd like to do is have the testifiers come up and just speak for a couple minutes, and then I can help address any questions that you might have, if that's all right.
I'd like to remind the testifiers to please state your name for the record and any organization that you're affiliated with.
Yes, Dave,
share that.
To be short, because...
And to be very short as well.
Hi, my name is Jeff Grable, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 2469. Just like to share my experience. When I purchased a dog as my first dog, very nervous about getting my first dog. I found one in the newspaper. I drove about 80 miles to go meet them. We met at a Dairy Queen parking lot and signed the papers on the hood of a car. They had a whole bunch of other dogs and cats in the van as well. They seemed to be in kind of a hurry. They seemed like nice people, but they just seemed to be in a little bit of a hurry with everything. I signed some papers on the car. They told me that all their shots were given to them. I found out later that wasn't true. They, my dog Maddie got sick and almost died about a month later. We had to give her lots of IV fluids and antibiotics, and she was diagnosed with distemper, which is a neurological disease, and they should be vaccinated against that. Basically what happened was they refused to believe that the dog had the disease. They're very unsympathetic about it. And they didn't want to take my phone calls anymore. They said, we'll give you a new one. But at that point, I didn't want just a new dog. I wanted some answers. And when it was all said and done, I paid about $1,400 in vet bills and didn't really get a whole lot of accomplished by this. It was pretty much just a horrible experience. And there's these breeders are still selling today. It's just the average breeder in the newspaper. It's very hard now knowing where to go to buy a dog. They were USDA licensed, but that didn't really seem to mean anything.
Mr. Clark, you might want to really, you've got about 1 minute left for all your presentation, so I'll extend it a little bit.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Hi, my name is Pearl Ward, and I'm the co-executive director of Retriever Golden of Minnesota. Retriever Golden is a non-profit golden retriever and retriever rescue group. We've rehomed over 3,000 retrievers since 1985. 2007 was a record year for our group with the intake of over 700 dogs, 213 of which were taken directly from inhumane breeding facilities. In the last few years, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of our intakes from irresponsible breeders, and these are both USDA licensed breeders and non-licensed breeders. As director of this rescue group, I've been asked to provide some subject matter expertise. Ragam has become a nationally recognized authority on such intakes, and we see a distinct difference in the types of dogs we see that come from reputable homes and breeders, or versus dogs that are rescued from inhumane breeding conditions. The types of issues we face are two categories, psychological and either behavioral, and the physical. We see a long list of physical issues that we must take care of veterinary care: ear infections, dental diseases, untreated foot and limb fractures, untreated fight wounds, embedded neck chains, paw sores, malnutrition, emaciation, upper respiratory disease, hip dysplasia, and other congenital defects. But we also see psychological and behavioral issues, which are equally as severe. Many forms of aggression, many forms of anxieties and compulsive disorders, and dominance issues. One example is Nikki came to us at 40 pounds overweight, and along with a dozen of normal ailments, worms, cells, ear mites, ear infections, Nikki could not walk. She scooted herself along with her 4 feet, dragging her back in behind. She had torn both ACLs, and this breeder was still breeding this animal. Minnesota does not license set standards or inspect regulate dog and cat breeders, and the industry does not self-regulate. So if we're addressing there are 22 states that already have puppy mill laws addressing this situation, with more addressing it each year.
Mr. Streff, are you going to testify to on this? Because you're quite a bit over your time already, and...
Sir, if we could ask just Mr. Streff to speak for 1 minute.
Okay, I'd be glad to hear from Mr. Streff because he is a renowned expert on it.
Good afternoon. My name is Keith Streff, and I'm a senior investigator with the Animal Humane Society based out of Golden Valley, and I've been working in that capacity for about 21 years. I'm here to support the bill in its original context for a variety of reasons, many of which is that there are no specific state laws that regulate dog and cat breeders in the state today. While there are some licensing facilitators that deal with federal law, state law doesn't preclude any of that currently. There are dozens and dozens of loopholes that exist with the existing enforcement resources. Minnesota has between 2 and 3 USDA inspectors. There are literally thousands of small and mid-range and large-scale breeders. And many of the inspection reports show serious violations of which are never corrected from year to year. Having worked in the industry for 21 years, I have never been involved with or participated in any federal intervention regarding a breeder in my entire career, no matter how abhorrent the condition. So clearly we need something that's going to regulate and license and address the problem before it becomes acute, and I would encourage your support.
Okay, thank you. Then we'll have to go to the opposition. And I haven't been contacted by one organizing for the opposition. I have 3 people. I believe Dr. Linda Wolf, Belinda Donley, Bob Reese, Nevis, or something like that, in that order. And is there anybody else that wants to testify in opposition? Are you one of the 3 or?
Mike Bryan.
Oh, okay. That's on a different, sorry, it's on a different sheet here. Okay. Okay. And Ms. Jacob Berger again. Okay. Expert on everything here. okay. That'll be the 5 then, and we'll give each 2 minutes to testify. And go ahead in that order. I'm sorry, Ms. Wolf?
This will be Subliminal Learning 101. My name is Dr. Linda Wolf. I've been a veterinarian for more than 20 years, and I've been in the field of veterinary medicine for over 35 years. And in that time, I've been asked to investigate and comment on breeding establishments throughout Minnesota and throughout other states in the United States. I've recently been the investigative veterinarian on the McDuffie breeding case in Morrison County. I've seen firsthand the conditions at a number of Minnesota puppy mills, most recent being a 600 breeding fish puppy mill in Morrison County. My wish over the last 30 years is that puppy mills would become a thing of the past, a bad memory, but as long as people are ignorant as to the conditions these animals are raised in, as long as people aren't aware that purchasing animals from pet shops, want ads, internet sources, all support the atrocious puppy mill trade, then the next best hope I've always had has been to improve dramatically the conditions these animals are forced to endure.
Yes. Sounds. Am I missing something? It sounds like you're for it.
Yeah, hold on. Wait, you get my next.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
That's 10 seconds you took off my time.
Okay.
That said, you would think I am here to support HF2469. I, however, am not. And I'm here to ask you to please not accept the bill as it stands. I think there's things that could be added to it that would make it beautiful, but as it stands, I ask you not to support it. Some people would say that any bill addressing pet breeding is better than none at all. I strongly, strongly disagree with that. The version does not address parameters that most need addressing. Let me get into that. The bill will exclude Minnesota's largest commercial wholesale breeders from needing to comply with any new standards. In fact, the likelihood that new standards are established after this is put into effect and the current status quo could be a lot more difficult to obtain. The bill tends to target the smaller breeders or breeders that, while maintaining the status quo for Minnesota's largest puppy mills. As the bill stands, it states that a breeder licensed by the United States Department of Agriculture must comply with all federal standards and regs governing the license holder. Well, they already are supposed to be doing that. And it is those exact standards that most of us in the front line of animal welfare and going into these breeding facilities and large-scale breeding facilities find to be appallingly, appallingly below humane living conditions. Even though there is a section that states the board could work to adopt new rules for standards of care for dogs and cats, the rules are supposed to at that point apply to breeders who are not licensed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So it would not include those large-scale breed facilities that are so horrendously in need of a change. It will not affect the largest entities that should be the target of any kind of bill that we really are going to put out there, and that is large-scale breeders. There is absolutely a need to change standards and increase regulations. I cannot say that these people are it's needed, but I believe this bill in its current form could actually hamper efforts to improve standards of care in the very arenas that need it most. Thank you so much for giving me this time. After 35 years, I have a whole lot more to tell you, but in 2 minutes, that's all. If you want any more elaboration, I'm always, always available to talk to anyone.
Okay,
thank you.
Mr. Darman?
No, my name's Bob Wise. I'm replacing her.
Is Belinda Danley here?
Donley?
Donley?
Yeah.
Are you going to...
I'll take her time.
Okay.
I'm the president of Minnesota Pet Breed Association. We're a relatively new association. We attempt to educate our members. We do a lot of seminars and meetings. We have knowledgeable people, veterinarians, come in and speak to us. So there are those of us that are trying to do a good job within the industry. I hear a lot of negative things about all the poor puppies that have been sick and stuff, but we also get a lot of letters from people that are very happy with the puppies they receive. There is a demand out there, and good, responsible breeders are covering that demand and doing a good job of it. Most of us are USDA licensed, and it's not like you're led to believe. They come in and inspect us, and depending on inspectors, some of them, a cobweb up in the corner will shut you down. So it's not like we just float along and aren't held to some responsibility. There are veterans in the industry, I'll agree with that, but we do also, at this time, have animal cruelty statutes that can deal with these people. I've seen some pictures of the place passed around here. My question was, were these people ever prosecuted? There are laws for that. Back in 1994, the Commissioner of Ag put out an order in conjunction with Minnesota Federated Humane Society and many others, came together with a standard of care for dogs and cats. And this has pen size, how many times you have to be watered, fed. It's extensive. There's several pages of it. There's also a lemon law on the books where people can hold you accountable for the animals you sell them. So I'm concerned about, like I said, most of us are USDA breeders that are in our organization. If I understand it right now, if Minnesota does attach to the USDA breeders, that cost could be another $900 for a license. This is figures that I've heard. This is a seven-day-a-week job. We normally, most of us have family members that help. If you want to make money, don't raise dogs. We do it because we love them, and they bring a lot of happiness to people. There are those of us that are responsible. I say, go after the bad ones, but how are you going to do that? I think violations mean everybody within the state is not going to do it. Those that are flying under the radar will continue to do that, and they'll remain back in the woods where we don't even know where they're at. So I don't know what the answer is other than maybe enforce some of the laws we have on the books, try to make them work before we start a whole lot of study and data, start passing more legislation. I appreciate you for time.
Thank you. Mr. Fry?
Hi, my name is Mike Fry. I'm the executive director at Animal Ark Animal Shelter, the second largest animal welfare organization in Minnesota. And I would like to first start by thanking the committee here for looking into this issue. As you can tell, it's a very important issue. It affects the lives of a lot of animals and a lot of people who purchase those animals. I believe that this bill started out, with the best of intentions. The people who wrote the bill really wanted to improve the standards of care for animals in these large-scale breeding facilities. But along the way, I think the bill just lost its track. The specific area of the bill that I have problems with and our organization has problems with is Section 5.1 A and B, and that's the section that is, in effect, exempts the large-scale USDA commercial breeders from needing to comply with any new standards. Representative Hornstein told you in his introduction that some of the pictures that you have in the packet that he gave you are from USDA facilities. The existing USDA standards for that section of the code, in effect, endorses, allows the keeping of a golden retriever, for example, an adult golden retriever in a cage the size of a human bathtub for its entire life on wire floors that are cutting into the paws of those animals' feet. That's the standard that we need to increase. The only way we're going to clean up this industry is to provide increased standards of care, not take the low standards that are already on the books and entrenching them in our state law, which is what this bill does. You add more credibility to the existing low standards, and you're going to make it harder for groups like Animal Ark to increase those standards later, because we'll not only have to fight with USDA, we'll have to fight the state, we'll have to fight Board of Animal Health rules. We will be fighting to increase those standards on multiple fronts if this bill passes, and logistically it will be virtually impossible for us to do that, and those pathetically low standards will be entrenched in concrete if you pass this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jacoberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Fred Jacoberger. I'm an attorney residing and practicing in Bloomington, Minnesota. I happen to be national legal counsel for the Cat Fanciers Association, Inc. For those of you who have not heard of it, that's the feline version of AKC. We're the largest registry of pedigreed cats in the world. We have some 600 member clubs in the Americas, Europe, and Asia. Put on over 400 cat shows per year through our clubs, and by far have the largest registry. So we know something about what's going out there in the pedigreed cat world. I can assure you that pedigreed cats are not commercially raised to any great extent at all. We have 49 breeders worldwide who have had more than 20 litters per year. 49, that's worldwide. None of them are in Minnesota. Cats are raised in homes lovingly. Often the queens are giving birth in people's bedrooms. Mine certainly did when we were raising Burmese cats several years ago. It's a whole different operation. We do not have big operations in cats, so I wanted to make that distinction to you. The second thing I wanted to add that I think nobody else has said here today is that you're not plowing new ground with this type of legislation. It has been plowed over and over and over on state, county, and city levels. Laws like this exist in operation elsewhere and have for several years. You can go look and see how effective they have been. Now, I've emailed each of you and given you in the email some of the facts regarding the efficacy of bills of this nature. They are not effective. They do not achieve the purposes they state. They do not raise any money at all. And to the extent they are funded out of general funds that I don't think you're going to want to think about. Think about the number of inspectors you're going to have to carry this out every year, what officers are going to have, what transportation they're going to have. Simply do your due diligence. Look at the laws that exist now, and you're going to find out they don't work. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Members, I think there's some requests to go on and testify, but I don't think we can possibly get that and get the other two bills in.
For the author, is he going to come back?
Yes, I think we'll start our 10-minute discussion period now. I think the people are available to answer questions. Representative Cornish?
Representative Hornstein, has there been, Mr. Chair, has there been any thought to making an omnibus talking cat bill to bring all three of these together? Because it's so confusing to go from one end of the spectrum to the other. I really believe there should be permitting and licensees and inspection. We've been ignoring this problem for too long, and I don't believe that all the laws don't work. Maybe they're just bad laws, but I like sections out of Representative Famar and Lesh's and Hornstein's bill, certain parts of it. It'd be nice if we could weld one in together, because this abuse is gone on too long, and we need some kind of inspection. And that's, usually I'm an anti-regulation person, but when you hear these stories, and then one of them says a lack of fatal dog attacks, a big deal. It doesn't have to be not important because nobody's killed. It's just the attack itself and the horror that that inflicts on people. So I believe there should be more regulation, but some of these are really onerous. And have you given any thought to putting this into one? And
Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, Representative Cornish, I mean, this is a new area for me. And responding to some concerns that I heard, you know, in my district and elsewhere, and hooked up with these folks. And, you know, it's really up to the committee, and the chair, I think, in terms of how to package these. I think it was, you know, we joked about it, but it's very serious. The fact is we have five bills now before the legislature, as you pointed out, and it clearly is an issue for the public. I've learned carrying this bill that people are passionate on both sides, and, you know, however the committee through its process wants to handle it would be appropriate.
Representative Cornish.
I'm chief of police now in a small town of 2,500 people, and we had a person already take a bunch of puppies and put in a bag and go out and run over and back and forth the car to kill them. And we've had a number of instances just in a short time where the conditions around puppies and dogs are deplorable. And we got some tools to deal with it. The, you know, prospective dangerous dog and a dangerous dog, but we can't get to everybody. The only ones we're getting to are the complaints, and that's why I wish there was some type of inspection procedure. And I hope some of these bills make it out of here and then maybe get refined after they leave.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's what I was going to bring up to Representative Cornish. Representative Hornstein, do you have, maybe I just missed it in the bill, but do you have a place or do you have an idea about where you're going to have a resource if this does become law, like, you know, what the breeders have to do, the requirements they're going to have to go through, like some sort of resource or checklist or something so they know what they're going to have to go through?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, I believe that is in the bill, and I'll ask our
Mr. Clark,
our experts to confirm that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Representative Bingham, the way that I look at the bill is the bill basically does three things. The bill calls for a license, okay? Anyone that has six or more breeding females for the purpose of sale must be licensed in the state of Minnesota. So that's the first thing it does. Second thing it does is calls for an annual inspection. And again, the pictures that are in your packets, they're not going to be prevented until someone goes on the site and looks. The third aspect of the bill are standards of care. And representing this is right to your question. What was talked about earlier, those folks that are currently USDA licensed would have to continue to comply with USDA standards. The second class of breeders, which are those folks that do not sell commercially, okay, that do not sell directly to a pet shop, those folks would have rules promulgated by the Board of Animal Health. So that gets to your point. That's a long process. The rulemaking process is a long process. There are some definitions in the bill that direct the Board of Animal Health to cover certain areas. And I think it's interesting, Mr. Chair, in the testimony in opposition to the bill, I think I heard there were at least two people that came up and said that the standards are not strong enough, while there were a couple that said that maybe they're too onerous. So I think we're getting close to moving along on the right track. I would also like to add that Representative Hornstein and Representative Moe have been talking, they've been working together, trying to carve out or develop a bill that would be satisfactory to many of the interests. This bill, Mr. Chair, if you move the bill today, will go to the Ag Policy Committee, is what the recommendation is, and folks that have concerns about the standards, and I assure you, they will be vigorously looked at in the Ag Committee.
Representative, I just have a clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is that just so people can go to some sort of website and have a checklist to make sure that they're complying with issues. That's my question. That's my point, I guess.
Okay. Representative Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little tough, but I apologize, I forgot your name. But how do you respond to the concern expressed by some of the opposition that what's being proposed puts into law bad policy that actually makes things worse and chances in statute?
Ms. Minion?
Mr. Chairman, city members, it's a little confusing to me, the statements, but I think what they're referencing is that we have best management practices, which, as you know, aren't enforceable. There's out there things to do, and they won't be readdressed. There's animal welfare statutes, which don't address animals in breeding facilities, and so that's why we need something crafted out like this. The other items, I'm not sure what they're referring to.
Representative Immer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I suppose, first off, I keep hearing all the talk about what this is going to help. In fact, if the USDA regulations are already there, clearly they're not working the way that you would think they would. And we do have laws on the books. I just think that this one goes way too far. And I would ask the author to refer to page 4 under inspections. And I have two questions. The first one is, what kind of feedback did you get from breeders in terms of violating their Fourth Amendment rights? Because you've got what I think is an unconstitutional provision where you're going to give folks the right to enter their property. Granted, you tried to cure it, or whoever drafted this tried to cure it by putting in during normal business hours, but you're trying to affect their rights in entering their property to do these surprise inspections. What kind of response did you get from breeders in terms of violating their constitutional rights, and how do you see this working?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer.
I want the attorney on the panel to respond.
Chair, I'd be happy to answer. Representative Emmer, I think we can make it two answers. From the reputable breeder.
I'm used to that around here.
Yeah, well, I'll give you two answers. From the reputable breeder, I think you would say, you know what, we're used to that because that's what the USDA does. They don't notify folks before they show up, and I think it's... it would be an interesting situation if that was the case. Mr. Breeder, I'm going to show up at your location in a week just to let you know, check out your situation. So the reputable breeder already has that through the USDA. I think the irreparable breeder, yeah, they might have a serious problem with that.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Emmer?
Counselor, that's an interesting answer, but I'd invite you to come out to my district, because I'll tell you what, there's a lot of these breeders that are in my district, and they're going to tell you, and they're going to tell everybody else from down here in St. Paul, I don't want you on my property unless you're invited. If they're inviting private persons onto their property, and those people who are doing business with them see something that they think is inappropriate, that's fine, but they don't want Big Brother. They aren't asking for Big Brother to show up at their doorstep and say, this is normal working hours. I know a guy out in Dassel who breeds Drahthars, German Wirehead Pointers. Normal business hours for him are 24 hours a day. People board their dogs there. People buy dogs from him. He is a reputable breeder. And that's word of mouth. So I can tell you right now, I do know, because I have talked to some of my constituents,
They think this is an unfair, unconstitutional intrusion of government, yet again. Mr. Chairman, the next question that I don't know...
We have two more members on your side, and we're out of time now. I'll let it go a couple extra minutes, but you're cutting into them, because we are going to get... I'm going to lay over my own bill, but we're going to get Representative Paymar's bill on today.
I guess that's the way it's going to work. We have questions about things that we're trying to represent the constituents that elected us, but we're under such time constraints here that we're not allowed to do the inquiry that we think is necessary to make a reasonable and fair determination. I'll be done then.
Representative Cole.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I know that Ms. Cheney from the Board of Animal Health is here. I was hoping I could ask her a couple of real quick questions.
Ms. Cheney, are you... quickly.
Mr. Chair, members, I have a number of concerns about the bill. Having just had an opportunity to sit down and listen to the testimony, read the bill. One of the things we're doing here is we're expanding greatly the role of the Board of Animal Health beyond what exists today. And so, Ms. Cheney, my question is: Has the board looked into what it would cost to I don't see a number in here for the license fee, but you're going to be required to regulate this. What would you be charging breeders?
Ms. Cheney?
I'm Quinn Cheney with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the Board of Animal Health. And we did do a fiscal note on this, and our anticipated license fee cost is about $900 per breeder. But that's assuming... there are about 500 breeders, and we really have no way of knowing how many there actually are in the state. We referenced the state of Iowa has 243 licensed breeders. Kansas has a little over 500, but Missouri has 1,900. So, of course, the cost of the fee could change significantly depending on how many there actually you would have to license.
Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Chang, thank you. I guess I have a completely different question, but I heard... I don't know if it was an email or something I heard, but a new bovine TB case was brought to my attention. I believe it was confirmed within the last, very recently, 24 hours maybe. And it's my understanding that the Board of Animal Health now has some new obligations or is going to have some new obligations with regard to that. Can you address that in terms of the priorities for the Board of Animal Health and how that new bovine TB case, assuming you can confirm it, I just heard it, what that does in terms of your resources today?
Ms. Cheney.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Board of Animal Health announced this morning, confirmed this morning, a fourth case of bovine tuberculosis in Beltrami County, and that case puts us over the limit of the number of TB cases that we can have in our current status, so it downgrades us. And that will result in new restrictions for livestock movement and dairy will all have to be tested. That is the board's primary focus right now has been the control and eradication of these sorts of animal diseases, and we will be probably coming forward with a request for some additional authorities and some additional funding in order to try to control this outbreak.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would just note that, I have a bunch of concerns about the bill, but the entity that's going to be tasked with regulating this new licensee is already strapped and already has pretty significant priorities. I think the bovine TB is a huge concern, and that's where I want to see the Board of Animal Health focusing its attention, at least in the near term. I agree with some of the things Representative Cornish and the intent of the author here. I don't like seeing these pictures any more than anybody else, but we got to be. Our job is about making some tough choices sometimes, and the Board of Animal Health can only do so much, and I'm concerned about a $900 fee when they're already strapped.
Representative DeLaForce.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can be brief because Representative Coles and Mr. Jacoberger raised the same point. Representative Coles, if you look beyond that, it says that the board may delegate the authority, so there's a concern there that this will simply become a burden that's pushed to a lower level, either to the county or a municipal authority, probably well funded through fees, as best they can do it. And I know Representative Hornstein that you've been working with Representative Moe, and I know that legislation can change, and I'm certainly willing to move the bill along, knowing that you two will work diligently to reach some kind of compromise. But this isn't the committee, but I hope there's a committee down the road, whether that's Ag, that's going to look at the fiscal note and perhaps the local impact note here and weigh and assess that as well, although this isn't the day to do that in this particular committee.
Ag Finance will do that. Okay. The vote is now on the motion by, let's see, is it by FEMA, to pass it with recommendation and pass it to Agricultural, Rural, Economics, and Veterans Affairs Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Thank you. That's easier. All in favor, raise your hands. All opposed? No. Oh. You had eight. Okay, 8-7, it passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee.
Representative Tamer, can you present your bill quickly? Representative Tamer moves his bill, and does this go to
the chairman? I would
local government. I heard.
I'm not, Mr. Chair. I'm not really sure. I'd like to move House File 2906. I understand local government would like to see it, but I also did not request a fiscal note on it. And I there is a felony provision, and I don't know if it needs to go to public safety finance.
Well, that would be after local government.
So it would be a, so I would move
so the
file.
The motion is to go to local government, and let's see. We'll set 5 minutes to each side. I believe you've agreed to that, Representative Paymer, correct? And
that's fine.
So that we have several amendments, I understand, on this, so that there'll be time for discussion. So, Representative Paymer, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 2906 gets at the issue of dangerous dogs. The proposed legislation strengthens existing laws by giving animal control authorities the tools that they need to better protect the public from dog bites and dog attacks. Professionals in the field of animal care and control agree that with very few exceptions, dogs are not born dangerous. They are created by irresponsible ownership. Minnesota's existing law defines a dangerous and a potentially dangerous dog by outlining how a dog acts without provocation and the type of threat, injuries, and damage the dog might inflict. Existing language also stipulates that a designated dangerous dog must be registered with the local animal control authority upon proof that the dog has proper enclosure, the owner has been issued a surety bond, has paid a fee, and has a microchip identification implanted in the dangerous dog. What we're doing here in House File 2906 is, in Section 1, we're defining provocation. In Section 2, 3, and 6, we're transferring the duty of issuing dog registration, collecting fees, etc., to the Animal Control Authority. In Section 7 and 9, requirements and confiscation, this is the section that requires a dangerous dog to be sterilized at the owner's expense. Section 8, deals with limitations. Section 11 deals with the disposition of seized dogs. Section 12 has certain restrictions if convicted. It prohibits further dog ownership under certain circumstances. Section 13 increases the penalties. Again, what we're trying to do here is saying through this law that the owner should be on irresponsible dog owners. And I want to point that out. I think most dog owners are responsible. This is for the irresponsible owners in our communities.
Section 14 deals with the destruction of dogs, and Section 15 deals with applicability. With me is Bill Forbes from the Minnesota Animal Control Association to make a couple brief remarks.
Okay, I'm Bill Forbes. I'm Secretary Treasurer of Minnesota Animal Control Association, or MACA. I've also been an animal control officer for a bit over 25 years now. I realized I don't have a lot of time, so I had a fairly long list of things to say, and I'll try and cut it short. Currently, we have a law that doesn't really do a whole lot to the dangerous owner of dogs. It's the dog itself that generally pays the maximum penalty. The dangerous owner of dogs goes out and gets another dog after his dog has been ordered destroyed, and he's starting on a clean slate because everything is kind of pointed at the dog, and that is not the issue. There are no good statistics, which is going to come up again and again in this discussion, I think. There's not a lot out there on some significant numbers that we should have, but nobody does, and that is numbers of a particular breed in the community and percentage of those particular breeds that are involved in attacks. As far as owners of...
You've got about 30 seconds to go.
About 30 seconds. Okay, sorry. I got hearing aids from working in an animal shelter. Again, there are no statistics really to cover this, but animal control people agree that you can point to several characteristics of a typical owner of a dangerous dog. It does not have to do with race, ethnicity, income, any of those things. But what you do see is that they're primarily men, although we're seeing more women fitting into that category. The dogs are generally not properly trained or socialized by the owner. They're often chained up either in the house or outside or both, which causes dogs to be aggressive. They're often allowed to roam loose and are not supervised. Children belonging to that household frequently are not supervised around the dogs. The owner frequently has a history of domestic violence, violent crimes, animal neglect or abuse. They receive a lot of tickets. They often don't pay those tickets and may not even show up in court when the summons is issued. We see a lot of DWIs, a lot of suspensions of driver's license for expired plates, no insurance, fail to pay fines, disorderly conduct, drug issues, property crimes, unlicensed dogs, and previous ownership of potentially dangerous or dangerous dogs. And most of the dogs that are involved in these sorts of things are intact males, that is to say, not neutered. The primary bit of this bill is the prohibition against ownership of dogs by persons who have repeatedly shown that they are not able or willing to deal with dangerous dog issues that they are creating.
Okay, we have to go to the other side so that Who wants to testify on the other side opposing the bill as it stands now? Okay, then we can go to discussion. I think what we're going to do is we've got four amendments rather than discussing the bill now before it gets amended. I think we'll do the amendments and then discuss whatever the bill is in form at that point. So I think Representative Rush, you're kind of the amendment.
Is there an A1 amendment up? We don't have one. That disappeared. Okay. Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. I'm going to point out, members of the committee, this is my bill right here. This is the bill banning five breeds of dogs from the state of Minnesota in its entirety. And I have not dropped it in the hopper yet because I feel like I can give advocate for a different mode, an opportunity to show that they are seriously interested in public safety. I would point out this bill is in the Public Safety Committee for a reason, and the amendments that I have drafted attest to that. And I will speak as we go through, Mr. Chair, if I could take them up in the following order. A5,
A3, A2, and then A4. The reason I want to bring them up in this order is because the first two, A5 and A3, are non-Green-specific amendments. I think all of the amendments make the bill better. We should have a discussion about these, but I think preliminary A5 and A3 should happen first.
Representative Rushton, do you want to move the A5 amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rush moves the A5 amendment to get it in.
Get it in my form.
Pardon?
No, thank you. Okay, you want me to discuss A5, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Well, because I don't know that Representative Paymer wants to accept this.
I will accept the A5 amendment. I think it's fine.
Okay. Since the author, then, to get this in the shape that the author wants, we'll take a vote on that. All in favor of adopting the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
It carries. Okay. Representative Rush, do you want to discuss the A5 amendment now?
You want me to discuss it? You amendment after you pass it?
That was
A5.
Okay.
I can say briefly what it is, Mr. Chair. A5 is
treating it as if it was an author's amendment so that we pass it to put it in the shape that the bill that the author wanted, then discuss it.
Oh, I see. I understand. Okay. Well, I'll say briefly what we just did then on A5 to put that in the bill was A5 is what I call the concealed carry pistol amendment. And if you got a dog that's been designated as dangerous or potentially dangerous, you treat it the same way that if you want to carry a concealed weapon, for example, and you need to take a class to get a license for that, the federal court requires. So this is an education component for the dangerous dog law, that if you have a dog that has in fact committed some act that makes it a dangerous animal, you got to take a course similar to the way we enacted that course for the concealed carry law.
Can I just ask Representative West, I think we'd be fine with it as long as it was dangerous dog, but we would like to delete or potentially dangerous dog from section 1, from 1.4 and 1.5. But we'd be okay with the dangerous dog provision.
Mr. Chair, you're talking about the A3, I believe, right? Are you talking about the A5?
A5.
Okay.
On lines 1-4 and lines 1-5.
1-4 and 1-5, and also on the back, apparently. What about on the back? It has potentially dangerous dogs. Is that also?
Also on line 2.2. And 2.3.
For clarification, I was treating it, because Representative Paymer wanted to accept it, I was treating it as putting it in the shape that the author wanted it. So that we normally just, we vote to do that normally and then discuss it. Okay.
Well, is it, Mr. Chair, then do I hear Representative Paymer making an additional motion to remove a portion of which we just included? Is that the motion on the table?
Mr. Chair, I apologize for that. When I saw the amendment, I was fine with the issue when it came to the issue of dangerous.
Can we?
But,
why don't we treat it just go back to a regular amendment?
We should move to reconsider the A5 amendment, move it back before the committee, and then we can have some discussion about it.
Good idea.
Okay. All in favor of reconsideration, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
You think you got it.
Thanks, fine.
And Representative Paymer, I don't know whether, what is your position on this amendment?
I'm sorry?
On the A5. You want?
Mr. Chairman, we're not quite there yet. It's a silly process thing, but we now have to vote to take it out of the bill. It's still in the bill, Mr. Chairman.
We voted to reconsider.
Now the question is,
should we approve the amendment?
Should we approve the amendment or not?
Right, and I thought we were going to allow a discussion as to what the author wanted before we voted on approving the amendment, don't we? I think.
Mr. Chair, just point of parliamentary inquiry. I believe that the motion on the table, just so we're all on the same page, I believe the motion on the table now is Representative Lesch's motion of the amendment.
Right.
And so therefore we are, as that is the motion, I believe Representative Paymar will then be making a motion to amend the amendment. Is that your,
right,
do you agree with that, Mr. Chair?
My understanding is Lesch's amendment is the motion now facing us, and then
thank you.
Representative Paymar wants to change, argue for a change in that amendment, which
I
would be allowed
we're on the same page.
It's an amendment to an amendment, so it would be allowed.
May I be heard on that then, Mr. Chair?
Representative Lesch.
I have a question for Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar, I know you and I had discussed this with respect to, and you had generally thought it was a good idea. Apparently you talked with some other people since then and thought that it was good for dangerous dogs who had either killed or seriously harmed someone, but you don't think that it's okay to take classes for someone who has a dog that has repeatedly attacked people?
That could
happen. Our concern is with registration of potentially dangerous dogs. We have no issue with classes or anything like that. The registration for large numbers of dogs, there are a lot of potentially dangerous dogs out there, and we don't register them currently. If we have to start doing that, it will cost a lot of money, I think, in terms of time and effort and paperwork. Part of this law as it exists is to be proactive and attempt to locate and identify animals that could be a problem, hence the name potentially dangerous. And if we start getting into this kind of thing where we have to register them and so forth, it'll create more trouble than it causes, I believe. But the educational provisions, hey, I think they're great.
Mr. Forbes, can you describe then, I don't understand the difference because it's not been discussed yet, and I think members of the committee would like to know the difference between a dangerous dog and a potentially dangerous dog.
A potentially dangerous dog, I'm going to pull open my statute book here to make sure I get it right, has not committed or caused substantial bodily harm to any person. It has not killed a domestic animal off its property. What it has done is an unprovoked bite on a person or a domestic animal. It has chased or approached a person, including a person on a bicycle on the street, sidewalks, or other public or private property, other than the dog owner's property, meaning it has chased somebody down the street or chased the mailman 3 yards away or something like that, not on the owner's property. Or it has a known propensity to endanger public safety by causing an unprovoked attack or conducting an unprovoked attack.
Mr. Chair,
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Forbes. Then, Mr. Forbes, is an animal owner of a potentially dangerous dog, one who has been designated potentially dangerous, are they entitled to a due process hearing under Representative Paymar's bill before their dog is designated as potentially dangerous?
Mr. Forbes.
Well, Representative Flash, members of the committee, Chair. All this is happening very fast. There's a lot of verbiage in here. Certainly would have no problem having hearings if we're going to start requiring things that constitute, I don't know the legal term, a taking or something like that, a restriction of some privileges to a dog owner. If we start doing that for potentially dangerous dogs, I think we would have to allow a hearing process. So we would have to do some work on that section.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, because I didn't hear you. Did you say that a person does get a due process hearing before it's designated, or no? And they don't? Or
I don't believe so. I'm digging deeper. I don't recall we had anything to do with potentially dangerous dogs.
Not for potentially dangerous dogs, for dangerous dogs before they are before they're seized.
Can we go to Representative Holberg? Did you,
Mr. Chair? I I don't know what we're even discussing at this point. If we're talking about the A4 or the A5.
We're talking about the A5 amendment and the Paymar amendment, oral amendment to the A5 amendment is what we're discussing.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, my understanding looking at the A4 amendment, which has the definition of a potentially dangerous dog, is that that's pretty subjective. And if there is no due process to refute somebody calling your dog a potentially dangerous dog, and then you have to... I'm looking at item number 2 here, when it says, when unprovoked chases or approaches a person, then it gives a bunch of places, in an apparent attitude of attack. And then if somebody witnesses that, then I got to go take a class. Because they say, well, that's a potentially dangerous dog. I think this is a little heavy-handed.
Well, then, Representative De La Forest.
And Mr. Chairman, I'll pass since we're on the amendment to the amendment. I had a question dealing with another part of Representative
West. Okay. Can we vote on the amendment to the amendment?
There's a number of spaces, but there's a number of places now where we'll have to take out potentially dangerous dogs if we want to.
With 1-4 and 1-5, and
and then also on page 2, on 2-2, 2-3, 2-5, and 2-6. So that would be my motion.
Right there. Okay. Council says we have to get rid of subdivision 1. Is that right? Change under registration A becomes 1. No. Just cross off A after the word registration on line 17.
And then, Mr. Chair, just a question before we go too deep into the technicalities of the next piece. I'm wondering if Representative Paymar actually wants to delete all of paragraph B on page 2 since eliminating the words.
That's what I was just going to. So, the Paymar amendment is to delete subdivision 1 under subdivision 2 after word registration, take out the parens A and the parens, and delete 2.1 through 2.6. Okay. All in favor of the Paymar amendment to the A5 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Carried. Now we're back to the A5 amendment. Mr. Representative De La Forest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the author of the amendment. Subpart 5, beginning on line 22, the course of instruction. Has a course of instruction been developed? Do we know? Is this a 2-hour course? Is it a 20-hour course? Do we know what the cost would be? And third, do we know of the availability of persons who are certified or with advanced training in ownership? We run into this issue frequently with these courses that you get folks in greater Minnesota or even in some outlying metro areas that got to go drive 300 miles for a 2-day course that runs a few hundred dollars. So I'm wondering if you can give us any assurances with respect to the burden that would be placed on the owners of the dogs defined in the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Davis-Worth, no, I don't know, and no. I anticipate that it would be done in the same way. This was drafted roughly in a similar manner that we did a concealed carry language, and I drove a few hundred miles up to Representative Walls District to do that, so... I anticipate people will choose their courses, who they use for those, and that can be developed later on. But I don't think that's necessarily the proper business of the amendment as I tried to draft. We can work out the details later.
No, Representative Latch, this is the committee that works on the details, but we'll leave it at that.
Okay. All in favor of the A5 amendment as amended by Representative Paymar's amendment, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
No.
The no's carry.
Sure, would you like me to be heard on the A3 amendment?
Representative Paymar moves. I mean, Representative Lesh moves the A3 amendment. Representative Paymar, do you want to make a first comment on it?
I would oppose the amendment.
Okay.
What?
The A3? Representative Lesh
opposes potentially dangerous dogs. And, if Representative Lesh wants to try to work on these between, he's also on the Public Safety Finance, aren't you? If you'd like to work and correct these amendments, maybe we could hear them as we go through the process, but I would oppose the A3 amendment as it's drafted.
Representative Lesh, would you be willing to, we didn't know this was going to, this bill when we scheduled, didn't know it was going to turn into a whole lot of other bills.
Right, and Mr. Chair, I would say, if I may, I did shop these amendments to nearly every member of the committee, and A5 and A3 had general agreement among everyone, and it seems like we're changing that between and then and now, and I understand sometimes this all happens pretty quickly, but there was general agreement among people that we did need courses for these individuals and for the insurance, which is required at a very low level now, but only for dogs that have nearly killed someone or seriously harmed someone. So I have some other amendments that I could be heard on, but if I'm going to be fixing Representative Paymar A5 and A3 between now and then, obviously I'm going to need to know the people that I want to talk to that apparently have talked to you before the committee today. So I can certainly do that. And I would withdraw A3 in light of that, Mr. Chair. But I would like to be heard on A2 and A4.
Today?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We've got a minute left of time. Well, we can try and go over quick. Are these non-controversial? Or?
No, they're not non-controversial. Mr. Chair, we could just save it for the floor. That might be more appropriate. I can get a motion from the dog pound, Mr. Chair. We could say that for the floor. No, Mr. Chair, if Representative Paymar is willing to have these things when they go to his committee, we could certainly do it there as well.
I would imagine that no matter what you do here, it's going to come up again there, and so
or Representative Hillstrom's committee for the matter, Mr. Chair.
Or Representative Hillstrom's committee. Whatever Representative Lesh wants to do on this. But
well, I want
to
do it now, Mr. Chair. But I'm trying to compromise because obviously there are many people here interested today who are interested in the subject of this, and the discussion is going to go on. So I guess, Mr. Chair, if I could, I would ask Representative Paymar if he thinks it's an appropriate venue for his committee to bring these amendments up in his committee.
Representative Paymar?
Chair, I think this should be dealt with here in the policy committee.
Okay. Sure. Okay, we'll have to, unless Representative Hillstrom and Representative Lesh can agree, otherwise we'll have to lay this over recess till probably 6 or something like that to do this. Is there any no agreement there? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if you can recess till 5:30. I have a public safety finance meets at 6 o'clock.
Representative Paymar, the way this is going, I doubt that a half hour will end it. But this is not encouraging. I have no problem with recessing until 5:30, but there's other committees meeting until then, so we can't start any earlier than probably about 5:40, maybe. We can try for 5:30, but being realistic. Representative Lesh, did you have something?
I can be prepared to go at that time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Also, the chair will recess until 5:30. We will have to find a room to go to because we had none planned. So the committee is recessed.
while we're waiting, Representative Lash, why don't you describe the...
Okay.
Let's say the A6 amendment has been moved by Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first two amendments, A6 being the first of the two, represent, and I think I told myself once upon a time on legislative tenure I would never use this phrase, but it does represent peace in the valley on discussions between all of us and based on modified A5 and A3 amendments from prior to the time we adjourned or recessed. So this A6 does say that if you have a dangerous dog, you have to take a course, and however, it removes the provision stating that if you have a potentially dangerous dog, you need to take a course. And so just to clarify for people, the only individuals who would have to take a course in animal safety and training would be those individuals whose dogs had committed serious bodily harm or killed another individual or killed another animal, as I perceive it. And one moment. Bill Forbes may be able to speak to that better, but I think it represents an agreement from both sides.
Sure. Representative Painmeyer, is that correct that you're accepting of this amendment?
Chair, I'm going to accept this for now. I do want to meet with Representative Lash and others as the bill moves on. I just, for instance, don't know how people would become certified to teach the classes and how this might happen in Greater Minnesota and how we pay for it all, but I think that these are items that we can work on as the bill moves on. But this is an effort to try to accommodate a compromise here.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Is there any discussion of the amendment before we vote? Okay, all in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Ash moves the A8, is it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You want to describe that?
Mr. Chair, A8 represents a modified A3, which prior to that time required insurance. As the current law stands, you don't have to have insurance for a dangerous animal at all unless your dog has been declared dangerous, and there it's only $50,000 that is required. I think many people are familiar with the fact that $50,000 covers almost nothing in the way of personal injury or health care. And so we thought it much more appropriate that liability be raised to the value that is typically required for auto, which is $300,000, and it also represents a compromise. I did remove the potentially dangerous designation from the H3 amendment, and therefore we have the A8 amendment. So that's all I say, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Paymar, are you agreeable to this one?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, Representative Lesh, whether you or maybe someone on staff knows when the last time this amount was changed, if ever. Maybe it was always set at $50,000. When was the date of enactment?
Representative Chair, Lesh. Representative Simon, to the best of my knowledge, it was 1989.
Representative Simon.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Lesh, I guess, you know, inflation would counsel us to increase it anyway. Once every two decades or so. But $300,000 comes from the auto insurance.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I mean, yes, it is a pretty standard level of liability, and so we thought that was appropriate based upon homeowner coverage. Although, you know, there are many people also that have million-dollar umbrellas on their homes for liability as well, but this is a basic coverage level.
Any further, Representative?
Just one question. Sorry. Do you think, Representative Lesh, do most umbrella policies, would an umbrella policy typically cover something like this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, yes, I believe it would.
Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor of the A8 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carry discussion on the bill.
Well, Mr. Yes. Chair, I did want to offer the A2 and the A4 amendments.
Representative Lesh offers the A2 amendment. Representative Lush, would you describe A2 amendments?
Yes, I will, Mr. Chair. Members, A2, just to be clear, does not represent peace in the valley. But I think it's very important that this be addressed regardless anyway. And by way of apology also to Nancy Minion sitting back there, who thought that I had said I would not offer these if we achieved some kind of compromise on the first two. I still begrudgingly went the direction that I did on the first two, because I think it's a step in the right direction, although I think it's very important, members, that there be some accountability for dangerous animals, not just after they've mauled or killed a child. I think we need to take some action prior to that time. And members, I am passing out, and if I could get a page to help me pass these handouts to you, or maybe I'll just pass them down. I'll give them to Kaylin here. He'll take care of it. Of the two handouts, one of them is a Centers for Disease Control study, and another is a Merritt Clifton study, who is the editor of Animal People in Clinton, Washington. And it provides a more full view of the accountings of animal attacks based on specific breeds. The amendment itself repeals the prohibition, which was also enacted in 1989, along with a $50,000 liability limit, stating that municipalities could not enact any breed-specific legislation on their own. I don't think that's right. I think it represents adverse influence by special interests who decided that they don't like any breed-specific laws because they see it as a slippery slope. On the contrary, members, if you looked at the Clifton study, which states at the top, dog attack deaths and maimings, U.S. and Canada, I would note the CDC study specifically addresses fatal attacks in the United States between 1979 and 1998. The Clifton study is an exhaustive compilation of numbers between September 1982 and current November 7th, 2007, just this last November. If members look at this document that you have in front of you, you see that it includes the top heading, bodily harm, attacks against a child, attacks against an adult, deaths, and maimings, which I think is important to keep in mind when you just look at deaths. You are looking at some skewed data, and I'll use an example. Huskies, for example, have a high rate of a death compared to some of the others, but virtually all these attacks occurred, these deaths occurred in Yukon territories, Alaska, or other areas of the country, which may not account for a good statistic of how typical it is or the chances that you have of being severely injured or killed by an animal like this. And I'll use the example, if you just turn to the page 2 of this study and look about maybe one-fifth up from the bottom of the page, you see Pit Bull Terrier. And when you look at all the other statistics on this page, you will see and that the first column is bodily harm. There are mostly single digits, the vast majority of single digits of animals, these breeds, affecting bodily harm. But when you look at Pit Bull Terrier, it's 1,194. You look at deaths, it's 116. Maimings, 654. Members, this is vastly disproportionate to the percentage of animals, of pit bulls in the general dog population. We have peaked out currently, and this is according to the study as well, at about 5% of animal ownership is pit bull, yet they account for, according to the CDC study and this Merritt Clifton study as well, over 30% of these vicious attacks. The numbers don't lie, members. And I understand there are many people who are very opposed to breed-specific legislation because they think it's a slippery slope. But if you take a look at this study, and, for example, the CDC study is less conclusive because it only takes into account deaths. But if you look at the Merritt Clifton study that has bodily harm, deaths, and maimings, you see it exhaustively addresses your chance of being harmed by one of these animals vis-a-vis your chances of being harmed by another animal. And this takes into account also the percentage of animal ownership in the United States and Canada, because this does include both the United States and Canada. I want to address another aspect of this, as long as we're on this, of removing the prohibition against cities from enacting breed-specific ordinances. And I would address this by saying some people liken this to racial discrimination. And I'm personally offended at the suggestion that dogs are people. They're not. You and I on this committee have all taken an oath to protect the rights of people under the United States Constitution and the Constitution of the State of Minnesota. And we add, and this is the Public Safety Committee. Public safety, people are entitled to the right to public safety. But dogs are pet ownership. They represent an opportunity for animal ownership, which is protected under the Constitution as well, but it should not outweigh public safety. I don't think that discrimination against various races or ethnic groups can be likened to ensuring that we don't have adverse consequences from dog attacks when they represent such a huge percentage of attacks. And members, I'd also add that you cannot account for this simply on how the dog is trained. People say blame the deed, not the breed. They also say that it's the owner who should take responsibility. As a prosecutor who prosecutes animal cruelty cases and dog attacks, I can tell you it's extraordinarily difficult to get a conviction. And I'll use an example of another animal, an Akita, that was outside a coffee shop, tied up outside a coffee shop in St. Paul this past summer. And a man went in the coffee shop, tied up his Akita outside. A woman saw the dog there for a while, bent down to give it some water, and the Akita bit half of her lip off, requiring reconstructive surgery. Now, the only thing that the city of St. Paul was able to charge her with, which is an ordinance that essentially precludes an individual from sticking their dog at another person, failing to restrain. But there's no way we could get a conviction on that. And yet this victim went uncompensated, and there was no accountability held for the owner. There's nothing that you could do. Yet this Akita is an animal that represents a far higher percentage of attacks relative to the number of Akitas that there are in the United States. Now, the CDC study specifically cites pit bulls and Rottweilers. But the Merritt Clifton study that you have in front of you also includes Akitas and Chow Chows because they are a much higher percentage of attacks. Now, wolf hybrids, I've gotten a lot of emails, and many of you have gotten a lot of emails. Wolf hybrids, there's general agreement across the board, people saying, yes, there probably should be some prohibition against wolf hybrids. There is a suggestion from other oppositions to breed-specific laws that, well, you know what, you can't do this with dogs because dogs are domesticated. And I've asked repeatedly kind of what that means, and the answers that I've gotten was that, well, they're not like the wild animal bills that we've taken up in the legislature over the course of in several years ago, because those are wild animals, lions and tigers and bears, these trans bill. But the fact is, members, that when dogs are bred selectively throughout the years, they can change. I mean, the fact is, when you have animals that attack this much more and affect this much more injury and death, we have to take that into consideration from a perspective of public safety. German Shepherds also have a higher percentage of bites. However, members should recall, or members should recognize what we're talking about here. And many of you got an email that you don't want to do this relative to dog bites. You don't want to ban dog bites. We're not talking about dog bites here. Dogs are going to bite. They bite all the time. Probably most people at this table have been bit by a dog. We're not trying to ban dog bites. It's the severe attacks, maulings, and deaths that we're attempting to prevent. And if you can see by the Clifton study that those breeds, the five that I've designated, account for a much higher percentage of those severe attacks. The experts will tell you that German Shepherds are prone to different types of bites, and they can include grab and drag, guiding nip, and protective nips, which do not account for a severe injury tally that you see in the statistics. I would just state, members, getting a sense that, you know, I know where things generally go on this bill. I've heard the rhetoric from the special interest groups. But I would ask you to consider in your own districts the rights of the victims in these cases as well. And oftentimes we say you have a right to own a dog, absolutely. But too often the rights of victims go unaddressed. And I'd like to read you one part of the Merritt Clifton study at the end, a quote from the study of Merritt Clifton, who's the editor of Animal People.
It is sheer foolishness to encourage people to regard pit bull terriers and Rottweilers as just dogs like any other, no matter how much they may behave like other dogs under ordinary circumstances. Temperament is not the issue, nor is it even relevant. What is relevant is actuarial risk. If almost any other dog has a bad temperament, someone may get bitten but will not be maimed for life or killed, and the actuarial risk is accordingly reasonable. If a pit bull terrier or a Rottweiler has a bad moment, often someone is maimed or killed, and that has now created the off-the-chart actuarial risk for which the dogs, as well as their victims, are paying the price. Members, the reason why I designated these five breeds initially is because the actuarial scientists in insurance companies recognize this risk. We're not talking about the number of bites. We're talking about how bad the injury is. You can account for that better than any other way by the breed of the dog, hands down. Now, I've tried to do this any other way, by the size of the animal, by other factors. You do a temperament scale. You can't account for it on the size. You can't account for it on the temperament scale or the size of the animal. The breed is the most conclusive factor that will tell you what is your chance of being harmed. And if you got a bad owner who owns a Chihuahua, you're probably not going to worry about taking your kid around the block as much. But if I'm walking my child around the block in front of a cage full of pit bulls, and you can tell their temperament, it's a different story. So with that, members, I'm sure there are plenty of questions, but I've gone on long enough. I would offer the A2 amendment.
Representative Baymar, I would guess you're not jumping at adopting this for part of your bill.
Not at all, Mr. Chair and members. And I'd like Mr. Forbes to at least have a couple minutes to
respond. Mr. Forbes.
But the last is comment.
We have to go through the whole who I am thing again, or can we pick up where we left off?
It's a recess hearing.
Well, I have not seen the Merrick Clifton study. I do know Mr. Clifton, and I don't want to disparage his abilities or his opinions. He's a very opinionated fellow who has sometimes very strange opinions. Is this Representative Lesh? Is this published in Animal People?
Representative Lesh. Normally we don't have witness asking questions of the we'll let it go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Forbes, it's an ongoing study that was emailed to me. I don't know for a fact it was published in Animal People, but he is the editor, so I'm guessing he did.
Mr. Forbes.
I would say that unless we have a refereed scientific study that is published in a reputable professional journal, I don't place a lot of weight on it. The 850-pound gorilla sitting in the corner that everybody seems to miss is that we just don't know the number of these various breeds within any given community and the number of bites that proportionally can be attached to those animals. We've had, in my community, some very serious bites. And of the most serious ones we've had in the last several years, one was, in fact, a pit bull. One was two golden retrievers. Another one was another golden retriever, which is the closest I've seen to a fatal attack, although the child wasn't terribly badly injured because he fell on his face instead of his back. And a yellow lab. It has to reflect the number of feral animals in the community. A golden retriever is a very strong, healthy dog that can do some real damage, and you're going to see some golden retrievers when they are so popular. And right now, we have pit bulls everywhere in my city, and we have not seen an increase of any significance in pit bull bites to humans. We have seen more issues with pit bulls going after other animals.
Representative
Flesh. Thank you. Just in conclusion on that point, or by way of response, Mr. Chair and Mr. Forbes, I'm assuming you don't have any objection to the Centers for Disease Control study, which actually uses the same collection procedure as the Merrick Clifton study, and in fact, the numbers in terms of deaths for the time period between 1979 and 1998 is almost right on as much as the Clifton study is. If it's good enough for the Centers for Disease Control to take a look at the numbers in their collection data, I would think it would be good enough for another study.
Thanks.
Chair.
Representative Paymar.
I wonder if we could just have Beth Ziva for us to just offer a brief comment in response to Representative Lett.
Right. Oh, Ms. Ziva for.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. Representative, thanks for hearing me today. My name is Beth Ziva for, and I'm a director of a Pit Bull and Rottweiler rescue here in Minnesota. We've been an organization for 10 years. We typically save about 65 pit bulls and Rottweilers a year, and just to go on record, we've never had a human incident in the program. So we've had very good luck. I just wanted to point out a couple of things here. The statistics, the question study that Representative Lush is referring to is actually all based on press reports and media data. And if you've done any research, which I've done quite a bit the past couple years, there is an extreme media bias when you're looking at these types of breeds. Some of you should have an informational packet that we looked at, and to prove this, if you look on pages, I think it's 8 and 9, it goes over a couple different scenarios that a Canine Research Foundation looked into media biases, and actually there was a couple of situations throughout the country where there was just very minor injuries by a pit bull, and it actually made national headlines versus people who were mauled by a black Labrador or a breed that people typically don't consider dangerous, and it maybe made one local newspaper. So I think that's important to consider when you're looking at the credibility of that study. Also, I just wanted to touch on the CDC information. And the CDC study actually concluded, and their position statement for that organization is that they are against any type of breed bans. And they actually publicly came out and acknowledged the fact that their study is flawed. The data, the way that it was reported, the way that they allocated the bites was incorrect. And they have a position statement as the CDC saying that they are against breed bans and any breed-specific prohibition, regulation, things of that nature. So that's just something that's also in this packet. Another thing I wanted to touch on, and it's on page 8, is if you look at this study, breaking down the number of fatal attacks, in any basic mathematical equation, you need a numerator and a denominator. You need to look at how many fatal attacks there were in comparison to the amount of, breeds, the representation that breed has within a community. And pit bulls actually are a very popular breed, and pit bull actually is a generic term. Pit bull isn't a breed. Pit bull means hound. It encompasses 3 different breeds, sometimes even up to 25 different breeds of dogs. So when you look at the representation within a community, it's a very high percentage. You can look at the numbers and how they break down on page number 8. Lastly, I wanted to just make a statement. My career is in insurance, and I happen to work for the largest insurance company in the nation. And I'm not here to speak on their behalf, but I can tell you that they actually have absolutely zero breed restrictions. We insure 1.5 of every 5 houses in the nation, and they have found that it's not an effective way to sift through who's going to have a claim and who's not. So.
Thank you, Ms. De La Forest. Are you by any chance related to Representative De La Forest?
You can enjoy it.
Yes, that would be true.
Not that we would stoop so low to try to get
Don't hold that against. Mr. Chairman and members, Ms. De La Forest is married to my cousin, Adam. Oh. And they live in Representative Atkins.
Yeah, Joe Atkins. I'm going to watch him a couple times a week.
Representative Paymar.
I totally understand. I've had conversations with Representative Lett, and I think he's passionate about this. He's trying to do the right thing,
I just think that this is an unfortunate slippery slope for a breed specific ban in cities, and I would respectfully ask the committee to reject and oppose the Lesh Amendment.
Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor of the A2 amendment?
I have been looking through my emails, and I do not find any copy of the amendment, and I think I'm current through the 200 breeder dog emails that have been
200.
Sifting through. I'm just wondering if you have an electronic copy, Mr. Chair, or if Representative Lesh has one.
Representative Westrom, I can read it to you. It says Minnesota Statutes 2006 Section 347.51 Subdivision 8 is repealed.
And Mr. Chair, if I may clarify what that subdivision is. The subdivision, Representative Westrom, to paraphrase, states that no municipality in the state of Minnesota may enact any restrictions based on breed. And that was an amendment that was added into a 1989 animal bill in the House.
All right, Mr. Chair, I'm ready to vote on this one. I'd appreciate electronic copies of the other amendments as we're going to consider them.
Representative Westrom, I hope that can be done. I am not the one to, as people will tell you, that I am not the one that's going to accomplish getting you anything on a computer. Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Fails. Representative Lesh moves the A4 amendment, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Go ahead.
And without stating any of the same, because I made most of the statements that I would, since these are both breed specific, just to explain the amendment, Mr. Chair and members, it states that the five breeds that I had proposed banning outright in my original bill, the Pit Bull, Rottweiler, Akita, Chow Chow, and Wolf hybrid, are per se designated as potentially dangerous based on the established frequency of attacks. And just the only statements I would make, Mr. Chair and members, would be to rebut some of what has been said in criticism of the studies that are out there. Members, you all know that the numbers don't lie, and you can try to parse them any way you want, but anytime you get an organization that does a study and then comes around and says, well, yeah, but you shouldn't look at the numbers that way, you know there's political influence pulling at the organizers and publishers of that study. You can look at the numbers yourself and decide for yourself if these animals are more dangerous. It's right there in black and white. And because this is such a politically charged issue, as you can see with Representative Western's statements of how many emails we've been getting, it's difficult to sift through all of the garbage to find the truth. The truth is in the numbers. It's in the CDC study, and it's also in the Merritt Clifton study. Despite what people may say that you shouldn't read these studies the way the numbers speak to you, I would also state that these two studies collect their data the same way. I don't think there are too many people at this table who would argue with Ms. De La Forest's claim that there is media bias. We all experience that quite a bit in our positions. There's no question that, you know, you may suggest that the media covers some more than others. The fact remains we have to rely on the numbers one way or another in order to please silence all your cell phones.
What God is speaking.
With that, I would offer the amendment.
Representative Paymer, are you jumping to approve this amendment?
No, Mr. Chair. If Mr. Forbes could just take a minute or two to respond to the amendment.
Mr. Forbes? Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, I would point out that the major national and state organizations that deal with animals is their occupation. The National Animal Control Association, Minnesota Animal Control Association, the American Veterinary Medical Association, the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association, and what I would consider the three mainstream national humane organizations, ASPCA, Humane Society of the United States, and AHA, American Humane Association.
are all firmly opposed to breed-specific legislation, and I understand the Animal Humane Society in Twin Cities is also opposed. I took part in a task force on canine aggression and human-canine interactions that was convened by the American Veterinary Medical Association in the early 90s, and they issued a fairly thick report indicating what they thought should be done to control aggressive animals, dog bites, and so forth. And one of their findings was that they felt that breed-specific legislation was simply not the way to go. I would also point out that there are three refereed scientific reports that have come out in the last few years on areas where they have outlawed pit bulls specifically, and all three of those studies have shown that there was virtually no change whatsoever, and in one case the number seemed to go up in terms of attacks, and I would stand by that. Also, I would mention that when we start talking breeds, this original statute was passed in 89 as a result, in large part, of a fatal dog attack in Plymouth that was done by a Malamute. I can go on for hours, but I don't think we're going to do that, are we?
And Representative Famer is waiting to start his committee as soon as we're done. So,
Mr. Chair, I would respectfully ask the committee to reject the Lesh Amendment.
Is there any further, Representative Galen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just quickly breezed through this section of statute, and I'm wondering if Representative Lesh would agree with my statement that the effect of making a per se classification of these five breeds as dangerous dogs would have the same effect as the A2 Amendment, which we just rejected, which would allow local ordinances to adopt breed-specific bans. Is that your read as well, Representative Lesh?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, no.
I'm wondering if Council might be able to look at 347.53 and maybe...
Mr. Chair, I can explain my intent, maybe. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, what the previous amendment that just failed would have done would have been repealing the restriction on breed-specific ordinances by municipalities. This amendment we're currently taking up would designate per se potentially dangerous the five breeds as a matter of state law, which would based on the current bill, not do much more other than requiring a closer look at these animals. But if we had adopted the First Amendment, it would have given the opportunity to municipalities to do virtually anything up to including a ban. This amendment does not provide for that.
Representative Payman.
Okay, just in closing here, I don't know if anyone has seen this these pictures here, but they're... I was asked if I could identify a pit bull terrier, and I'll pass this around, but I think that if you look at this, to actually determine what is a purebred is nearly impossible, and this would be, I think, really be kind of a chilling effect for local governments in their own budgets to try to determine which animal is actually a purebred. But I'm going to pass this around here. I couldn't actually pick out the pit bull terrier. Kate, if you would do that for me. Thank you.
Just while we're doing that, several people must have their cell phones on. Please turn them off because it's creating a lot of problems within the mic system. Representative Kalin,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Lesh may be right technically that the effect of his amendment the A4 amendment is slightly larger than the effect of the A2 amendment, but it's essentially, just to clarify, it does appear from speaking with counsel that while the local ordinances wouldn't necessarily need to use the magic words of breed specific, they would be, the effect would be to be making breed specific bans by this language is essentially one degree removed. So I think it's fair to say that the breed-specific ban would be part of a larger umbrella.
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I don't deny, as I stated from the beginning, that these two amendments, the A2 and the A4, were both the exception to the other amendments I offered, in that A2 and A4 did address breed specifically. So in that context, yes.
Any further discussion of the A4 amendment? Okay, all in favor of A4, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
No.
No.
Failed. Is there any more discussion or amendments? Okay, all in favor of the motion to pass this bill and
refer to local government.
Yes. It's Representative Paymar's motion. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, no. Carries. Representative.
Chair Mullery for House File 3132.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move House File 3132. And then I will move the DE1 amendment.
Chair Mullery moves the DE1 amendment. This is merely to get the bill in the shape that you'd like it. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Let's take as is the protocol in this committee and others, we'll adopt the DE1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Proceed, Chair Mullery. DE1 is adopted.
Just to point out, the DE1 amendment, the only change on that from the original bill is this makes the purchase of ticket or otherwise gains admission to the activity a gross misdemeanor instead of a felony. What this overall bill does is it gets at the horrendous problem that we have in this country with training dogs and animals to fight. This covers cockfighting and dogfighting or any animal against one of a different kind. It's mostly dogfighting, of course, and as evidenced by the Vic case, it's become a real national disgrace. And Mr. Keith Streff, I believe the chief humane society officer in the state, and he's also, I believe, the highest law enforcement on the issue of fighting animals. He's here to testify, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Streff. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Certain people haven't turned their...
I hope it's not a dangerous dog call.
Good evening, Mr. Speaker and members of the committee. My name is Keith Streff, and I'm the senior investigator for the Animal Humane Society based here in Golden Valley. And I'm here to comment and testify on behalf of this bill that addresses the dogfighting and some of the issues going on with dogfighting, as many of you have heard in the most recent development with the Michael Vick case. I have some photos that are being distributed or perhaps you're looking at now. These are cases that I've specifically and personally worked on, and they came from actual cases here in the metropolitan area, specifically all of them in the city of Minneapolis. And what you're looking at there are photographs of dogs as well as paraphernalia and other training apparatus that individuals engaged in professional or even amateur dogfighting normally possess. The one photograph is the steroids and injectables and muscle enhancements and other performance enhancements there, as well as some dogs and a treadmill, which is very common apparatus to train these particular dogs to get them into the fighting condition necessary to carry on a fight that's got to go from 2 to 4 hours or to death, whichever comes first. The first photograph there is a dog that you notice. Ironic enough, in the photograph that was handed out by Representative Paymar as what may or may not be identified as a pit bull, you'll see that dog with the significant injuries underneath the underbelly of the dog. That is what you call your typical pit bull mix. And that particular photograph is a bait dog, or what they call baiters. And that dog is specifically used for the intent to train and otherwise be a sparring partner to the fighting dog. In other words, you want a dog that's going to fight. You don't want a dog that's going to fight too hard, because you want to build the confidence and the physical attributes of your fighting dog to be able to tear that dog up and get the fighting frenzy and still be able to get the physical fitness built into that particular training program. So what happens is these dogs that have pit bull mix or pit bull trade genetics in them are used to against in a practicing or a sparring match, if you will, against the typical fighting dog. And you see the damage and the injuries and the more intrinsic injuries that are caused by this kind of activity. I feel personally, in 21 years of investigating these kinds of cases, that I think it's time to address the fuel that promotes the actual dogfighting. The Michael Vick cases are the John Gotti of dogfighting. We're not going to see that here in Minnesota. Minnesota is more of an itinerant dogfighting state. They don't like our winters. Who'd have thunk it? And more of that professional activity is done down in the southern states. So as a result of that, the fighting season is relatively short in Minnesota, and those particular fighters are going to be engaged in the training, the attending, and the participating of a fight. So it's like a football game. If you can't sell a ticket, it's hard to play the game. So by increasing, in my opinion, by increasing the penalty to a gross misdemeanor or better for attending or purchasing a ticket to go to a dog fight, that's going to cut the supply and demand chain down, and those individuals that are engaged in the professional dog fighting at the levels of the Michael Vick is going to be significantly curbed. And it all comes down to an issue of deterrence. So if an individual is caught attending that particular fight, the increased penalty should be at least consistent with the actual engagement of the dogfight itself.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss.
Mr. Chairman, there's a person from the Animal Humane Society of the United States that would like to testify also on that.
Fantastic. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and as concise as you can be, the committee would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Jill Fritz. I'm the Minnesota State Director for the Central States Regional Office of the Humane Society of the United States. We have over 10 million members and constituents, and more than 159,000 members and constituents here in Minnesota, and I speak on behalf of them in support of this bill. Animal fighting is extremely inhumane and a violent activity that's taken place largely out of the public view until recently with the Michael Vick dogfighting case. Animals used for fighting are trained to be aggressive. They're often drugged and mistreated to foster aggressive dispositions. And for animals that survive animal fights, there are injuries that are extremely severe. They include broken bones, deep gashes, blood loss, shock, and infection, and rarely are those treated appropriately. If the animal fighting is a threat to public safety and associated with other criminal activities such as gambling, weapons possession, narcotics, and various violent crimes. I've witnessed this myself as part of the HSUS team that recently took part in the largest cockfighting bust in U.S. history outside of San Diego, where we confiscated over 5,000 fighting birds. And just today, the HSUS participated in the bust of a dogfighting ring near Tucson, Arizona, in which over nearly 150 dogs were confiscated. And there I saw evidence of all of these other crimes that go along with it. A recent 3-year study by the Chicago Police Department found that 70% of people arrested for animal abuse crimes have also been arrested for other felonies, including domestic and aggravated battery, illegal drug trafficking, and sex crimes. So we all know about that connection between animal abuse and violence against humans. But in a recent ranking of state dog fighting laws, Minnesota has ranked 19th to end of the week penalties for knowing spectators. While we make animal fighting a possession of animals for fighting felony offenses, being a spectator in an animal fight is only a misdemeanor. And it's important to note that the role of spectators in animal fighting is more than being a mere observer. They play two crucial roles. They're often participants in animal fights, and they finance them. Spectators finance the organization and promotion of the fights. The primary motivation for animal fighting is financial. They pay admission as high as $100 per person. They also gamble on the fight, sometimes thousands of dollars in one fight. Without the spectator element, organized animal fighting would not flourish, and they play a huge role in it.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Fritz. Chair Mulready, do you have anyone else you expect to testify?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone in the audience, noting the late hour and the other committees that still need to meet tonight, wish to testify for or against this bill? Questions from members? Seeing none, Chair Mulready, Representative Mulready.
Mr. Chairman, the motion is to refer to pass it with recommendation. Refer it to Representative Paymar's Finance Committee. To the Finance Committee, which will.
Yes, Representative Mulready renews his motion that House File 3132, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent re-referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Last bit of business before we adjourn tonight. Representative Cornish moves adoption of minutes from March 20th, 2007, March 21st, 2007, March 22nd, 2007, March 23rd, 2007, and February 18th, 2008. Any corrections, objections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Motion prevails, and we are adjourned.